You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 63. Relax. Enjoy your coffee. Okay. Hey, buddy. Good morning, everyone. Take a chill pill. What is it? Okay. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today with me is Diverter, and we are going to be talking about Bitcoin mining, specifically mining in home, and we're going to get into the whys and hows of that. So Diverter, welcome.
Thank you, man. Glad to be here. Glad to be on.
All right. So, you know, your setup that you've kind of you've put out this paper or whatever you want to call it on
novel.
doesn't it always end up that way? Like you start something and you think, oh, this is going to be like a one page write up. And then it ends up, you know, if you actually put, you know, time and care into it, it ends up being huge.
That's exactly what happened. I started out with the intention of a couple links and, you know, some information and, you know, it gets to a point where if I talk about this, then I guess I have to mention this other trade-off, and then I have to mention this other trade-off, and next thing you know, I have to cut it down to get it to 20 pages. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's back up for just a sec. Kind of, I know you value your privacy, and I want to respect that, and anonymity and things like that, but can you kind of, without giving too much personal detail, I guess, kind of give us your why Bitcoin for you, like why it matters for you and why the privacy stuff is important for you?
Sure. It's a story. You know, I know you've got other plans for your day, so I'll cut it down some, but, without going into a whole lot, I missed the initial birth and run up of Bitcoin, because I was in prison. That may shock some, may turn some off, but you know, it is what it is. That my fight against the man went the wrong way. In 2016, I discovered Bitcoin, but, I honestly just discovered it strictly from a trying to make money standpoint. I bought some because, you know, I'd seen that the price had went up in the past. I thought that maybe it would go up in the future. So I bought some, but I had no idea what it was. No idea whatsoever. I'm on Coinbase. I don't have a wallet, you know. So 2017, huge run up comes, and I miss a good portion of it because in my mind, I didn't understand what I had. I didn't understand what Bitcoin was. So when I made a little bit of money, I sold. And then I watched as this thing went crazy. And that's what really sparked it to me. Like, I know I just bought because I wanted to make a little money. There's no way all these people are buying this just because they want to make a little money. There's something here. And cue the rabbit hole. So, you know, when I dive down in and I start finding all the things that I was looking for in the past in my fight for freedom, I guess you would say, you know, the fight to just be able to do what you want to do without having to ask permission from anyone. And Bitcoin still to this day, despite the best efforts of some, still to this day is a permissionless system. You don't have to ask anyone to use it. You don't have to ask anyone to send money, receive money. You don't have to ask anyone to start mining. So once I discovered that, you know, how just unbelievably designed this system was, there was no way I could go back to anything else. Like I was all in. It was Bitcoin.
Awesome. So let's get into this. And your paper is list or whatever you want to call it, novel, whatever is, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But you've got it available on your Keybase, called it. Let's see. I had it pulled up. Was it just, yeah, mining for the streets. Okay. That's what I thought, but I didn't want to say it wrong. And so I'll kind of give my interpretation and then you kind of correct me where I'm wrong here. But the basic idea, you're doing in-home mining with, you know, maybe one or two ASICs. And so let's kind of get into that, because, you know, I'll give the standard, you know, the standard response, which is, but I was told that, you know, Bitcoin mining wasn't profitable anymore unless you have this giant farm. So where do we go from there?
Yeah, of course. And that's, it's so funny to me, because it seems like mining is like the one thing in Bitcoin that we tell everyone, or everyone is told, to just leave to the pros, right? And in conventional legacy systems and, you know, the stock market and things, that's exactly what they tell everyone in the general public. Leave it to us. It's too confusing. It's too hard. You guys don't know what you're doing. So leave it to us and we'll take care of it. Meanwhile, we complain about centralization of mining in China, you know, all these things. And everyone just seemingly accepts this dismissal that, you know, well, I guess it's too hard. Well, I guess I can't make any money. Maybe you can't, but there's other ways to look at this. You know, and depending on your situation, it actually can still be profitable for you. The advances in mining equipment are astounding.
Yeah. And to be fair, you know, I've had Austin Storms on here. I've had Marty Bent with their Great American Mining on here. And we have talked about, and there are a lot of little intricate areas if you are looking, that can be difficult to manage if you are purely looking at a dollar profitability for what you spend versus what you get back.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're going into mining, you know, with the business mentality, which I mentioned in the paper, you know, if there's mentalities that you take when you go in that are going to determine a lot about how your experience turns out. If you go in thinking this is a business, my home mining, my couple ASICs that I'm going to, you know, hook up in my garage is a business and I expect to turn a profit. If you're in the United States, there's a very good possibility that you're going to have a terrible experience. Now, that's not to say it can't be done. And Marty and those guys at Great American, especially in the capture of this natural gas, it's beautiful. And I love it. I love to see it. I love to see anything that brings hash rate to North America, to be honest. But there's an entire other mentality to it, where we see more and more these days that options to buy or obtain Bitcoin without having to go through these burdensome and quite frankly dangerous KYC and AML regulations in order to have it. I believe that we'll see more and more people forced into situations where they may start mining solely as a way to acquire Bitcoin without going through the KYC. And that's kind of what I wanted to touch on in the paper.
Okay, cool. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, you know, I've talked a little bit on this show about the dangers of KYC, but you know, if you want to go into it, like why it's a bad thing for you, like why you specifically think KYC is such a bad deal.
Yeah, well, so Bitcoin is so powerful. It really is a very powerful tool. If you look at it from an adversarial standpoint, like I would hope that everyone, at least at some point, has put a considerable amount of time into thinking about how, if they had virtually unlimited resources, how would they kill Bitcoin? And if you do that, at least from my standpoint, it's kind of hard to do from a brute force type manner. The game theory kicks in really nicely in my mind when I'm thinking about, you know, all the attack vectors and how it could be done and how it could be countered. And it looks really good and it's solid. And Bitcoin made a lot of trade-offs for security. I mean, it's a feature, not a bug. So how then could a government gain control over it? In my mind, it's the classic Trojan horse. KYC is the Trojan horse, and we're pulling it right through the gates because you can't necessarily force, you can't seize the assets. Like, you can go to someone's home and seize their gold or take their gold out of their vault, but you can compel them to disclose. So your ability to fight back on this side really hinges on your ability to defy those that compulsion to disclose your holdings and, you know, for example, custody with the government. A 6102 type order, you know, obviously wouldn't be the same thing, but in that same vein, I could very easily see where, you know, the government would require all people to disclose their Bitcoin holdings and maybe custody them at some government exchange that's regulated, or, you know, something to that effect, because it's very hard to just brute force take over the system or brute force kill it. You have to kill so much else to do that. But if I can just take away the censorship resistance by controlling who can send what, where, and when, then I've essentially killed Bitcoin. And it's to me, I don't think it's overstating the danger to say that, you know, KYC is that danger, that it is that Trojan horse we're pulling through the gates, that, you know, 5 years from now, whenever they're able to subpoena each exchange and get a full list of all holders and the amount that they hold, you know, what happens then?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of my concern. Or I think that's probably the big one for a lot of people is that it's a, you know, if people cannot get into Bitcoin without going through these gateways or not easily, then the government, like you said, doesn't have to control Bitcoin. It doesn't have to destroy Bitcoin. If it can just control the gateways, then that's good enough for them.
Essentially, that's it. And this extends to other coins. You know, when you hear a lot of the times from the privacy folks, you know, the just use Moneros and whatever, you know, the KYC is so pervasive in all forms of our lives, in all these coins, in all areas. Gray markets, in my mind, are so essential, and I believe we'll see a surge in gray market activity. I hope to avoid and evade these KYC sanctions and you know, allow some people to pull back some of that power.
Yeah. And then the other thing, you know, for me, and I talked a little bit with Matt O'Dell about this, but the other danger of KYC just in general, and not even specific to Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, is that, you know, these companies are typically not built to be secure platforms, right? They are not, a lot of them are not, we don't know how, well, that's the thing truly, is that we don't know how they're securing this information. And so, you know, we've seen exchanges get hacked and all of the customer's information get taken. Even if the Bitcoin doesn't get taken, we've seen the information get taken, and then, you know, that gets sold on darknet markets and people can do whatever they want with it, right? So
absolutely. And not only do they not, are they not so interested in protecting your data, you can go even further to the extreme that they're actively harvesting it to sell for the purpose of financial gain. They will sell your data. Not only will they just not protect it to the point it can be hacked, they'll give it away for a price.
Yeah. Are there known instances of that? Like proven ones?
Well, now when I'm talking about, I'm sure that, you know, I'm not talking about like,
sure,
like the Coinbase is selling your social security numbers and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm just these centralized honeypots of data, you know, it one bad actor gets the job done. A lot of times we saw, even if they don't even mean to, we saw the recent BlockFi thing with the guy, with the SMS 2FA, you know, like, come on, bro, SMS 2FA. So, you know, it's so dangerous. I can't overstate how dangerous this thing is. And that's not to say that we can completely do away with KYC, or that I even think that, you know, there should be no sort of KYC nowhere in the world. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that in order for us to maintain Bitcoin as a permissionless system, we have to be able to get into and get out of and use Bitcoin in a permissionless manner. And KYC is a big block to that right now.
Yeah. The BlockFi thing was both, though. Like, it was both that they, you know, it was not, well, let's say it's not a bad actor, but it was not done well on the side of, like, why was that employee using SMS as his two factor, but also, like, it was a marketing person that they SIM swapped. It wasn't. Why did that person have access to all this customer data? Anyway. Okay. So let's talk then. Do it.
Yeah. Anyway. Nothing. That's what I was saying. Anyway. Yeah. But that's the reasoning behind this whole, that's what sparked this whole thing. So,
all right. So let's get into then, you know, we've determined, like, we're not going to do KYC. Now, why would we do mining over something like BISC or HODL or one of these, you know, peer-to-peer exchange type places?
Sure. And I absolutely love, those peer-to-peer exchanges, especially the ones that offer some sort of, like, escrow protection for a buyer and seller. BISC, I'm a huge fan. HODL as well. So the thing about these peer-to-peer markets is, when we talk about dollar cost averaging, you know, that's all the rage is, you know, don't trade, just DCA, stack sats, dollar cost average, pile up sats constantly, whether the price is high, whether the price is low. And, you know, quite a few people have made some money that way, especially if you're able to maybe increase your buy level whenever the price has a significant drop. For example, you know, a few months back, we had that huge drop. If you had pulled up BISC on that day, you would see, you would see a total desert. It was just so barren. There were plenty of people trying to buy, very few people trying to sell. And I think that's because, you know, everybody kind of knew this was a temporary drawdown. So nobody's getting rid of their Bitcoin. We're just going to hold it and wait till it's, you know, it's worth more and then sell it. But what I'm getting at there is, in order to consistently buy, even when the price is low, you'll find in peer-to-peer markets that liquidity may dry up on you. And, you know, if you don't have another, like, say, maybe an ATM in your area that you can use without having to go through full KYC, then you're just kind of stuck. Mining can fill that hole a little bit. It's going to consistently stack those sats for you as long as it's connected, regardless of what the price of Bitcoin doing. As long as Bitcoin's producing blocks, you're producing Bitcoin for yourself.
Very cool. So it's like, you know, because this was something that when I changed over and moved away from KYC exchanges was my frustration, I guess, or I see the value in auto buy type places. I think a lot of the big ones, Cash App, Swan, Coinbase has done it for a long time, and that was kind of one of the few things that they actually did well was auto buy feature, right? It's just like you set this thing, you forget it just takes care of it. And so that's the hard thing with BISC is that you have to make yourself be disciplined enough to go in and do it on a regular basis. And like you said, the liquidity may or may not be there that day. Like you may go look and there's nothing. And they have a little mobile app that you can connect to your BISC instance that will, you know, when there's a, you can set these alerts, and if the price goes, you know, hits that threshold, or, you know, a certain volume hits that threshold, it'll send you a notification. But I personally have had issues getting the app, the phone, the mobile app connected to, the desktop, you know, instance. And so it's not as good as it could be there. And even at that, like, you still wouldn't be able to do it. You know, if I was at work or something like that and it sent me the notification, it's not like I can do all of that from my phone. So this,
of course. Yeah. Right. It still needs to be built out quite a bit.
And so this way of doing it would be, I guess, what am I trying to say here? This buffers that, you know, liquidity crunches, and if you're willing to, I guess this was kind of my thing, is like at some point I decided, like, is it worth, would I pay a convenience charge on one of these other exchanges to not have to submit KYC information? And I said, yes. Okay. Well, then I'm willing to spend more money on, you know, the increased price, the whatever that is, you know, like the whatever the percent markup over. It's a privacy convenience charge is how I had to change my mind to look at it. And I said, okay, like if I just view this as a privacy convenience charge, then I'm fine with it. So
absolutely, it's perception is reality for so many people, you know.
Okay, so then, so let's talk. I guess now that we've kind of determined why we would want to do this, and a little bit of the trade off there, like what would you need to get started on something like this in your home?
The infrastructure is probably the single biggest barrier to entry for mining. And that's only because, depending on where you're at, you may not have the correct voltage outlets in your home. In the U.S., you know, vast majority of residential homes or apartments or whatever, you'll find, generally, you'll find 110 volt outlets. Now, there are some miners that can be run on 110 voltage, and even like some S9s with the right firmware, you know, you can run on 110. But to get any sort of really good efficiency, to have any chance at being close to break even or profitable, or in an area where, as you said, it's an acceptable privacy premium that you're willing to pay, you're going to need one of these new generation miners, and they're 220. So that can be a problem for some people. It was for me. I didn't have 110. I'm sorry. I didn't have a 220 outlet. And I had all 110. I just called an electrician and had one installed. You know, I know that's like sounds like it's crazy and this whole big deal. It really wasn't. It cost me a couple hundred bucks. And threw it right in there. I had him put in an area where I felt like I would be able to stick a miner or two. I have four ASIC in a couple of different locations. There are two right here in my home with me. So infrastructure is a really big one. Making sure you have the correct voltage, the correct outlets, making sure you have the good internet connection. You're going to have Ethernet cables are going to have to be connected. You're going to have some sort of plan for dealing with the heat and the sound. Now, all those things can be mitigated, but it's very important to know going in what you're going to have to do to deal with all those.
Yeah. So is 220, that's what in America, like dryers are run on, right?
Yeah, you'll see a lot of dryers, maybe sometimes like even ovens, refrigerators, stuff like that. So there's definitely places where, you know, you'll find a 220 outlet in some areas, but you know, for the majority of the home, you're gonna
okay. And when you put in a 220 for an ASIC, does it look like a dryer outlet plug, or is it more like a standard wall plug?
Well, I actually had, because I knew exactly what I was doing, and you know, from an outlet standpoint, I went ahead and just had the style outlet, the Chinese style outlet that was going to come with the power cord. So I plugged that straight in. Now, actually, I plug in an extension, and then I plug the ASICs into the extension, because the ASICs that I run, the S17 Pro, the 50 terahash, they require two power cords. So, you know, if you're going to run two of them, you know, you're looking at four outlets.
Okay. So I'm trying to get this in my head. So your ASICs each have two cords coming out of them. And then those plugs,
yes,
the plugs coming out of the machine are the Chinese style plugs, or the plug in your wall is a Chinese style?
Yes. The power cord for the miner is a Chinese
okay.
style.
And then there's an adapter between that and your wall. Okay.
Yes. Yes. And I tried to link to those in the novel.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I did read that.
Put a link in there so that people could at least had a chance to get stuff. You can find a lot of that stuff on the Telegram market, but you know, just in case you can't find it there, it's easily bought on Amazon for a few bucks, you know, 15, 20 bucks.
Gotcha.
Not a big
deal. Very cool. Okay. So let's talk. You mentioned you run the S17. Let's talk about miners here, because it does, like you said, especially when you're running it in your home, that power efficiency really starts to make a difference. Talk us through what kind of miner someone should be maybe looking at if they're going to be doing this.
Sure. When I bought the S17s, I've had mine running. Let's see, where are we at now? I guess 8 months. I've had these S17s running now. Without a hitch, by the way. The only problem I did have was one that arrived at there were two hash boards running on it. One wasn't running. But all it was that the connection wasn't very solid. So I just unplugged and plugged it back in, took right off. But I say that because there's been a lot of trouble with the S17 model from Antminer. It's very well known. Their failure rate is something ridiculous, like 20-30, maybe wow, even 40%. I don't know. It's a really bad rate. Yeah, it's really, really bad. And, you know, for the longest time, Bitmain has had such a stranglehold on the ASIC market that it doesn't matter. Like, people are going to still buy them anyway because they have to. And then when you send them back in, so many instances when you send a damaged or a dead on arrival miner back in, so many times people have complained and swore that they either received the exact same miner back or they just received another dead miner. So there was a lot of problems with the S17 model in Bitcoin. Less so, it seems, with the pro models. There are many variations of all these miners. But I say that because, you know, there has been a lot of problems with it. Mine have been fine. The S17 Pro 50 terahash model has run great for me for 8 months now. Watch Miner, a micro BT Watch Miner, has come on strong lately. They're putting out some really quality machines, it appears. Now, they haven't been running for near as long as like the S9, for example. This is a warhorse, this thing. And I think that spoiled a lot of people. This thing has just, it's been amazing for the length of time that it's been able to run. But, you know, we're at a point now where difficulty in hash rate has reached a point where the S9, Bitcoin needs to be at this same hash rate and difficulty. And then Bitcoin price would have to be, I don't know, like probably 28, 30,000 before you would be in a break-even area on an S9. So that's an unacceptable level of privacy cost.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting anybody to pay 100, 200% markup to get some KYC-free Bitcoin. But with one of these new gen miners, the S17s, now Bitmain's coming out with the S19 and an S19 Pro model, which now these miners are kicking out. They're 100 plus terahash per individual miner.
Wow. Yeah.
That's just crazy. That's just crazy to think about. I mean, the S9 put out 13.5. And now here we are, you know, basically two generations later, major, you know, minor releases later, and we're at over 100 terahashes per unit. It's just insane.
So, what was I going to ask you? I just blanked.
Just to touch on the minor choice there, I went off on a little tangent there about the S17 problems, but I mentioned that because, you know, I hate to see people invest, you know, because it's a lot of money. If you're looking to get into this to buy KYC-free Bitcoin, most likely you're not sitting on, you know, a massive hoard of cash. So I don't want people to, you know, invest $2,000+ into a machine and then get a really expensive paperweight and have a really hard time being compensated for that. So I put those trade-offs in there. I linked to a Telegram group that is specially for the S17 problems that people have been experiencing, that, you know, they're kind of talking through and trying to figure out exactly what it is. But that's important to understand before you purchase your miner. It's important to understand other people's experience with them. Have they run well? You know, were any hash boards dead on arrival? You know, what's the failure rate? What's the hash rate? How much power am I going to use? That's where those mining calculators, the one I linked to of Scott Offord's, that crypto mining tools, it's a really good one. I also like whattomine.com and any of the other, there are plenty of mining calculators out there. Those are just some of the ones I like. But you can play with all the different variables. You know, you can change the hash rate, you can change the difficulty, the Bitcoin price, and you can run through all the different choices of miners at your electricity rate, wherever you're at, until you find something that, you know, that shows you some light at the end of the tunnel. You see something that, okay, well, I can work with this. This is you might even find that you're profitable, depending on your electricity rate, especially with the new, with the S19 Pros. Like, those things are so efficient. So, you know, you may be able to have 11, 12 cents, just a normal, regular residential rate somewhere in the United States, and actually be profitable mining Bitcoin at current levels. But once you go through and find the miner that kind of checks off all your boxes, then that's when, you know, it's important to start understanding what type of infrastructure you're going to need to actually, you know, put the miner in your home.
Got it. And then do you want to kind of talk about how, like, where someone would go, what the recommended sources are for purchasing? Actually, I remember what I was going to ask earlier. What are the differences between the Pro models? You mentioned a Pro model.
I actually haven't run any of the other new gens that aren't Pro models. So, I really don't know about, you know, how much better or worse they run. Generally, the differences are you have a choice in a different power mode. You'll get a little bit better efficiency. Like for the S17 Pro, for example, the 50 terahash model that I'm running, you have three different modes. You can run in a turbo, a normal, or a low power saving mode. Now those can come in handy depending on what Bitcoin is doing. So say, for example, we're sitting here right now, and all of a sudden, the Bitcoin price just, we get one of those stupid $1,000 green candles straight up. Well, hash rate, just, or difficulty, I'm sorry, just adjusted, what, yesterday. Okay, so if Bitcoin price jumps way up, that's inevitably going to bring more miners in. And bringing more miners in means blocks get solved faster, which means we get a difficulty adjustment like we just had last week, nearly 15% up. But that takes 2 weeks to get there, 2016 blocks. So if I'm going to try to take advantage of this inflated Bitcoin price right now, maybe I throw it on turbo mode. Okay, and now I go from mining, on an average of like between 50 and 51 and a hash, 51 and a half terahash. Maybe now I'm looking at something around 57, 58. Now I'm increasing my power usage, but I'm able to mine some more Bitcoin. And the same goes for low power. One of those $1,000 down red candle days, and all of a sudden your efficiency is not looking that great, and you're paying way too much. You can go ahead. No, that's fine. You can cut down into a low power mode, and you're going to cut back on the amount of Bitcoin that you're mining, but you're going to drastically reduce the amount of energy that you're using. So you can kind of, play with your efficiency level a lot more.
Awesome. Yeah, it's nice to have those options.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look at the mining calculator, sometimes you'll see that the 50 terahash model actually leapfrogs some of the more efficient miners in normal mode. The 50 terahash model in low power mode, for example, will be ranked ahead of, like, say, the S1753, even though in normal power modes it's better. But because there is a low power option, your efficiency is actually, it kind of leapfrogs it. So it's interesting to look at.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I wanted to, that's part of another reason I wanted to get you on and kind of talk with it, because I read through the paper and it's like there really is still, we talk about, sorry, my dogs are barking in the background. We talk about there's all these little aspects, and that's why they will say, I'll leave it to the pros. And there really are still a lot of little nuanced things, and I'm sure that's part of why your one page list of links turned into a 20 page report. But I've always found it fascinating, like all these different little things that you can do to tweak and adjust and get things right. And I think this is also why I think Matt Odell is good about talking about this, but when people will say like, oh, Bitcoin's not profitable above X price. And it's like, no, you don't, there's lots of other variables that go into the mix, and it just, everybody has to determine what price is profitable for them.
It's virtually impossible to say. I see this indicator on some of these TA charts all the time, production, Bitcoin production costs. And I could help but think to myself, I mean, for who? Like, because everybody's production cost is, can vary widely.
Yeah. Okay. You want to kind of briefly go over where are good places to look for mining equipment?
Sure. And this is where you can get scammed really easily. On a lot of these sites, if you go, just type in Bitcoin miners on the internet and go search, you'll inevitably hit a ton of total scam sites. Usually you can tell them, the price will be way too good to be true. sorry. If it's too good to be true, most likely it is. So what I tried to do in the guide was link to a sort of peer-to-peer reseller type environment, which is Hardware Market on Telegram. Telegram is super useful with the group chats and the amount of people that can come in and share information and post ads and stuff like that. The Hardware Market one is a very well curated group chat. And what they do is they have a set of verified sellers. Now, what that means is that these people have all basically KYC'd themselves so that you don't have to, essentially. They've given over all of their information, and with the understanding that if whatever, you know, scam operation happens, that that information will be handed over to any law enforcement or whatever the person that got scammed wants to pursue it with. So that cuts down drastically on the scam factor. When we ask to step outside of regulation, what that means is we now have to regulate ourselves. We don't need anyone else to tell us, you know, what we're allowed to do or who we should do business with or who we're allowed to do business with. We can do that on our own through systems like this, reputation systems, which the hardware market has. You can look at on there. You can see that this seller has done X number of successful deals, that you can look at their customer service, because a lot of the customer service is handled right there on the chat. So you can look through and see how they've handled issues in the past, and you can decide for yourself who you want to do business with. And wide variety of options there. From Hardware Market, the central hub, you can kind of branch off into each individual seller and their company. You can go to, you know, your Kaboom Racks or your Blockware or whatever the case may be. But it's a really, really useful tool.
Very cool. So, and price wise, I think I looked the other day, and an S17 Pro is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1,300. Obviously, that's subject to change, you know, with whatever, but that's what I saw the other day. Have they come out? Have they released the S19 yet, or is?
As far as I know, there was a guy on a Hardware Market the other day saying that he had seen some being shipped out. One thing I saw yesterday was a guy, which is another useful thing, is the guy tore down an S19. He basically tore it apart and posted pictures for everyone to see of the insides. As I mentioned earlier, the S17 line had, you know, just a litany of issues. A lot of it was to do with like the heat sinks inside of it falling off, glue pieces dripping everywhere. Like they were poorly made machines that seemingly just got rushed out, you know, to an eager public, you know, and why wouldn't you if you're the only competition?
Yeah.
But now you've got MicroBT jumping up with the WatchMiner, and all of a sudden you can't just put out garbage anymore, which is the beautiful thing, you know, as we've always said about the free market. Competition breed, you know, that's what brings out the best in the next company. So the S19, he tore down, and we got to look at the inside of it and how they've changed the way they secure their heat sinks, which looks like they're screwed in now. He says they're using a different type of glue. It's like a paste. So a few things that they've changed that are really minor changes, but from the looks of it, it looks better. Now, you know, as I mentioned in the paper, we're early in this deployment cycle, so there's no way to really say how long these things are going to run for. I don't know how long the life cycle of an S17 Pro 50 tera hash model is yet. I'll let you know when it dies, I guess. But all I can hope for is that, you know, you get one that does the job that it's supposed to do for as long as you can hope for, and then recycle and go into the next deployment. But the S19 looks really good on the inside, or a lot better, I should say. We'll see how it performs.
Anyway, okay, so let's go then. And sorry, listeners, we're having some technical difficulties here. Let's talk about, then you mentioned earlier, cooling and sound insulation and some things like that, especially if you're going to have this thing in your home. I had a friend of mine and you and I have talked about this before, but we kind of thought we had a novel take on some cooling things. And so we bought a couple of old, I don't remember if they're S7s or S9s, a couple of years ago when we're kind of playing around with them. These suckers are loud. And then the newer generations are like double the size. So I imagine although I know that they are more efficient, I imagine they're still pretty daggum loud. I mean, these are like I would drive up to the office that we had them running in, and I could hear them from outside the door. So, not really something you want sitting in your living room, on your kitchen table or whatever.
No, not especially not if you have a significant other or some kids running around. If you're some single dude, living in an apartment and whatever, you've got your electricity is included with your rent. Hey, man, fire up 5S9s on your kitchen table. You'll have at it. But for the rest of us, we're going to need to deal with this sound and heat. And they kind of go hand in hand. Those two.
Sorry, speaking of, I got interrupted by a child. and this is kind of a self-reinforcing problem, right? Because, or can be, or I guess self-reinforcing solution too, because, the noise is the fans, and the fans are trying to cool things down. And so, for me, I thought, oh, well, the easy solution on noise is to stick it out in my garage, except that a garage is super, my garage anyways, especially in the Texas heat, is super hot. So then the fans are actually even running harder, to try and cool the machine down.
Hard.
So, likewise in the other direction, if you can keep it cool, then the fans aren't running as hard. So what are some good solutions you've seen for in-home use or what do you use?
Well, and I thought about this before I put this guide out. The mining purists are just gonna kill me, because I'm not talking about firmware upgrades and I don't know anything about these miners for real. I don't know how these things really work. I just know that if I keep them cool enough, they're not super loud. So how can I do that? I want to get cool air in, and I want to get hot air out. And I want to make this sound be contained into as small of an area as I can. So when you're looking online, you'll run across plenty of solutions that people have come up with over the years. I mean, obviously, it's probably already been thought of. If you've thought of it, somebody's probably already thought of it and tried it. But that shouldn't discourage you. I mean, it should actually encourage you. I came across the cooler idea. And where, there is the ASIC is essentially sitting inside just a normal standard, igloo, whatever cooler. And you've got the cool air to flow in that you can use, just some simple ducting to duct in cool air and then get the hot air out. And it seemed like a perfect solution to me. I mean, it keeps the noise contained right there in that one little area. If I am able to keep cool air flowing into it, and then get the hot air away from it, then that should make sense. And it really does. So when I say cool air, it doesn't have to be absolutely freezing. Like, I'm sure there's plenty of miners in, maybe throw some miners in Iceland somewhere and they'll probably run great. I don't, because you don't have to worry as much about the heat. You don't want to make the miners too cool. It has to be above freezing for them, or it should be above freezing for them to work properly. But you want to keep it cool enough to where those fans don't have to work overtime, which then puts out all of the noise. So I just took a simple small window air conditioner, 5,000 BTU window AC unit. And I said, well, if I just pump cool air in here, then you know, surely that'll work. Now I'm worried about condensation. Am I going to be pumping, you know, cold air into here? I don't want to like shoot water directly into these chips. I don't think that'll work out real well.
Yeah.
So I toyed with it a little bit. I toyed with it a little bit first. Yeah, I had an empty cooler, and I made my little holes for the ducks, and I just shut the cooler, no ASIC or anything in there, and I shot some cool air. I wanted to see if I was going to introduce any water, what type of condensation looked like, just all the things that I could think of that, you know, maybe would screw this thing up. And it seemed to work. So, you know, what are you going to do? I threw it in there. This is 8 months ago. So, you know, like I said, the purists can come for me all they want and tell me about how terrible of an idea this is and how I should be doing X, Y, and Z. But 8 months on into running these things in with a window AC unit, pumping hot cold air in, and then just letting the hot air blow out the back end, it's working out great.
Well, cool. This brings up, though, to me, like, my immediate thought then is, like, how much more is that costing your on your electrical bill for to run that AC unit?
Yeah, and the AC unit, this is, you know, again, one of those things that it depends on your situation. You don't have to, like in my case, for example, I already had a window AC unit in one of the areas where I'm at. I'm not dedicating that entire AC unit just to this miner. Like, it's still doing its job. It's still cooling the room where it was put in to cool. But I've just took a couple little pieces of flexible ducting, and I'm just offshooting a little bit of that cool air into the miner. So yes, it's definitely an added electricity cost, especially if it's something that you're introducing new. All these things are things that are to be considered depending on where you're at. Maybe you're in an especially humid area and this wouldn't work out real well. Maybe you're in an area where it doesn't really get as hot as what we're talking about. It's so individualized, everybody's circumstances, that it's very hard to say, you know, do X and then Y will happen. Because I can't tell you what your setup should be like. But I can tell you that there are options. There are ways you can look for ideas. You know, you might just want to pop into the Telegram and just throw it out there. Hey, I'm trying to do this. What do you guys think? You know, these are Bitcoin guys. So by and large, these are guys that, you know, they get it. They understand the passion. They understand the want for some privacy. So, you know, they'll talk to you.
Yeah, the you know, a lot of Bitcoiners are tend to be really helpful. You know, we never actually explicitly said this. Going back kind of to the beginning, talking about no KYC, you know, a cool way to think about this basically is that you are paying extra to your electrical company and getting Bitcoin in return when you're running it at home. Like, you know, I talked a couple weeks ago to Brian Harrington, and we were talking about, you know, the privacy advantages to some extent of using something like BitRefill or Fold app. And I know there's people out there that would disagree and say that there's no advantage to using those. But I think there's maybe some advantage because, or I guess the trade-off is you're putting your trust in them instead of your credit card company or whatever. And you just see one payment to Fold app or whatever. And kind of in a similar vein, like you're getting Bitcoin by making a purchase, a larger purchase to your electrical company than sending money to Cash App or Swan or Kraken or whatever.
Yeah. Essentially your electric company becomes your exchange for, you know, and for all intents and purposes. You're giving your fiat money to pay your electric bill like you've done every other month. And, you know, the only difference is now you're getting Bitcoin in return. So, you know, that's all an exchange is. And it, you know, it's just another possibility.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned in the report is you talk about pools, and there's different types of pools with different payout methods and things like that. So can you kind of give us an explanation on that real quick? Or it doesn't have to be quick. You can, you know, I know there's always variables. So yeah, explain that.
No, it's fine. You'll notice that it's just pretty glaring that's the one part that I really glossed over. I papered over that quite heavily, and with good reason. Mining pools, they're competitive, man. They really do want, you know, as much hash as they can get, you know, to increase their chances of winning the block. The more hash rate that you can throw at the network, the better chances you have of winning the subsidy. So, of course, every pool is going to try to entice you in different ways to use their service. So there's different type of payouts. There's quite a few. There's like, if you really break it down, there's like 15 or so type of payouts, but there's a few major ones. There's the PPS, which is pay per share. So basically, even if the pool doesn't win the block, the miner still gets paid based on the shares that they contribute to the pool. That's a very high level overview here, so don't give me out on it. But that's essentially what PPS is. You get a steady income based on the amount of hash and shares that you're contributing to the pool. But in PPS, what's not included is the transaction reward. You're just paid out from the actual miner subsidy. So it's 6.25 Bitcoin now. Now, when you get into FPPS, the full pay per share, in that scenario, it's the same, except you also get a part of the transaction fees. Now, different pools do it different ways, but usually kind of what they do is they'll look at the average amount of transaction fees in blocks for like the last 24 hours, and they'll use that, you know, as a point to pay out to each miner for the shares that they contribute. Then you get in. So again, that's another steady income type of thing. All right. Whether they find the block or not, you should get paid for the shares that you contribute. You get into like the PPLNS, pay per last in shares, pay per last number of shares, basically. Now, the way that this works is you only actually get paid if a block is found. So essentially what happens is the pool takes on much less risk. The miner absorbs the risk, because if you're mining at home and you know you're right at break-even levels, well, the way you determine what's going to be your break-even level usually on these mining calculators is they're going to base it off of a PPS or FPPS model where you're getting a steady income. If you're using something like a PPLNS or one of the other type where you don't get paid unless a block is found, if your pool hits, you know, a bad streak, an unlucky streak, and doesn't come away with the block for the entire day, then you've just mined the entire day with no payout, which sounds terrible, of course. But the other side of that is if your pool has, you know, a sufficient enough amount of hash rate to be able to find some blocks during the day, then there may be days when you get really lucky with your pool and maybe you find 10, 12, 15 blocks that day. So what ends up happening is usually, you know, it kind of averages out to be around the same. Sometimes you get a little lucky one day, sometimes the next day, you know, you're not so lucky. But the big difference is the pool accepts much less risk. So usually what that means is they might charge a lower pool fee to the miner. So if you're on an FPPS pool, that means that pool is going to pay you out. As long as your miner is running and contributing shares to them that are accepted by the pool, they're going to pay you out. Basically a set amount, pretty close to a set amount. If they don't find any blocks, then that means that Bitcoin has to come just from them, from their coffers, essentially, from their pocketbooks. So what happens if you mine for a week and at the end of it, the pool didn't really find the blocks that it was supposed to find, and now they're supposed to pay you out your Bitcoin and there's no Bitcoin? Well, there's no really faking that. I can't fake make a transaction from the pool. I don't have my Bitcoin. And so pools can and have gone bust in the past. So that's something to keep in mind when choosing your pool. Is this pool big enough? Do I believe that even if they don't find blocks like they're supposed to, they'll make the payouts? Also, is the fee that they're charging me, like say, for example, they may charge a 4% fee. So they're going to take 4% of your rewards. And they'll take that 4% because they are, you know, taking all the risk on. If you use a pool where you're taking on more risk, they should be able to lower that pool percentage, maybe even really low. And there's a lot of different pools coming out right now. Like I said, it's very competitive. It's why I kind of linked to some places in Telegram where you can learn about the different kinds and hear from the actual pool managers, the people that's running the pools. You can hear from them, you know, why they think their pool is the best. There's some interesting new pools coming out, like Laurentia pool, for example, is a really interesting one that's come out now that, you know, they're using a little different method. So it's very intricate. It's a very personal type of choice, whether you're willing to accept a little bit more risk and potentially get a little bit more reward, or whether you really need that steady income.
Yeah. So wait, you're telling me that the mining pools didn't get in on that corporate bailout? Oh, bummer. yeah. All right.
I don't think they'd have a whole lot of luck getting anybody to bail them out.
Yeah. I don't think the Fed wants to bail out people who are actively diametrically opposed to their existence. It's probably not in their best interest. All right, man. Well, this has been good. Let's see if there was anything else in this report. So a lot of information. People need to kind of, you know, like we always say, do your own research, figure out what you're, you know, what you're willing to pay, what your needs are, what your capabilities are in your home. If this is something you're interested in, kind of plan out how you would do the cooling and the sound insulation and all this stuff. But a lot of good resources here for someone wanting to jump off into this.
Sure. And one of the things that I want to touch on real quick, just in case, because there are situations where maybe it's just not feasible for you to overcome all these hurdles. Hosting solutions that are around right now are a real and a viable option that can be looked into. I linked to one in there, which is Blockware. And the reason I did so was because, you know, a guy that I spend a lot of time talking with got extremely lucky and won one of the watch miners in a Twitter giveaway, believe it or not. And that was his case. It was just not feasible for him with his home situation, electricity costs, the whole nine. He just couldn't do it. So his choices were he could sell the miner and you know, just put the money in Bitcoin, or he can look for a hosting solution. which he did find at Blockware, and they gave him a really good, like, it's sub 7 cents on a single miner. Like, that's outstanding rate. And so now, you know, he's going to be able to receive those mining payouts, you know, from the his hosting, and not even have to run the miner himself. It's a managed hosting area. So that's something that, you know, even if you feel like your situation is just, there's just no way you can overcome all the problems or infrastructure problems that you have to deal with, don't give up on hosting either.
So when you say hosting, he owns the equipment, but they manage it and run it at their better electrical rates.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's his equipment. There'll be a contract, of course, that you'll have to fill out and go through them for a certain amount of time, like say for a year contract. And then you'll end up paying basically, like, depending on where it's at, obviously all the places are going to be different, but like there's like one-time installation and setup fees. And then after that, pretty much what you're going to pay is the electrical cost at the price they quote you at up front for the month. So, you know, at like sub 7 cents, 6.7 cents or so, I think his electrical cost was somewhere around $180-ish for that miner. And then when you look at the pool selection, it chooses an FPPS pool and gets that steady payout. That miner should produce him somewhere around like a 230 or so, you know, on the day the calculation was done. So he's profitable. He's quite profitable on a single miner. Now, you know, in his case, he was lucky enough to win that for free. So he doesn't really even have to worry about a return on investment. It's a total win. But for anyone else that is actually buying the miner, that's still that amount of profit. You know, that puts you in the ability to be able to get an actual return on your investment as well. So it's definitely a viable option.
Oh man, I had my mic muted. I just sat there and said, okay, so let me back up. Jeez, I thought we lost our internet connection again. I just had my mic muted so you wouldn't hear me clicking on my keyboard. Oh my gosh. Okay, everyone laugh at Josh. I'm laughing at Josh. Okay, so I said something to consider is that we didn't go over was return on investment you know, you have to consider for yourself what you know, what kind of time frame and what you're willing to spend and how long you're willing to wait for a return on that investment for the miners and any kind of electrical outlets you've got to add in and any kind of cooling and sound solutions and things like that. So just like you said, you have to spend the money up front, and then so how long you're willing to wait for the return on that investment and all that. So
yeah, absolutely. I made the argument in there that Bitcoin miners, you could very easily say that, you know, a GarageBand miner has the most bullish Bitcoin sentiment that you can have, because you're going to essentially have to make a bet that you're going to put up all this money up front without having the ability to just, you know, sell it on a whim and turn and walk away. Like, you're making actual hardware investments, infrastructure investments, contracts. You know, it's not something you're just going to turn and walk away from if you own all your Bitcoin on an exchange, for example. So there's a case to be made that the miner is the most bullish bet on Bitcoin that you can make. But it's definitely something that you want to pay attention to. I'm getting close myself. I think I looked the other day, and I believe around, hopefully, all things considered, about 90 to 100 more days, and I'll actually have my personal ROI. So looking forward to that day.
All right. Well, if you've got time, I got a couple of questions on Twitter. I posted out there that we were going to be doing this interview to see if anybody had any questions.
Sure.
Okay, Figs OS asks tips to navigate heat noise in a home mining setup. Yeah, we kind of touched on that already. So I'm not going to go over all that again. BTC Pats asks, natural oil cooled ASICs, viable or nah?
Hey, stranger things have happened. Immersion cooling is one of the exciting things coming in right now in mining. I mean, it's been around for a little while, don't get me wrong, but that's really interesting to me. So it's going to be cool to see how the immersion cooling kind of plays out. So who knows? It may very well be.
Yeah. You got to be, my understanding is that you got to get kind of like high end, top notch oils. You can't just be, you know, dumping 10 W-40 in there with it, but.
Right.
Yeah. Don't go buy like Johnson & Johnson baby oil and slather up your ASIC. But the basic principle is, right, you have a non-conductive fluid that you do actually immerse the whole thing in. It's non-conductive, so it's not going to short out your boards, but it's able to take that coolant away, or take that heat off with the liquid.
Yeah, absolutely. And by proxy, you know, the noise.
Right.
So it's really interesting tech.
Okay. And then last one, maybe you have some insight onto this one. Sam DeFries asks, which Crayola flavor is best? I don't know what that's in relation to, but.
Stay away from the green crayons.
Okay.
All right. Somebody been out here distributing green crayon. Now, these guys, I wear my bias on my sleeve. It's right in my bio. I am a samurai wallet, unpaid shill. I don't get paid anything, but I swear I'll shill it all day long. The mining for the streets, obviously, that's a riff on the samurai Bitcoin for the streets. I firmly believe that Bitcoin is a street technology at its heart. It's about the streets taking back their power and not having to ask permission from anybody to do anything. I didn't have to ask permission from anyone to set up a miner and start mining Bitcoin and contributing to the network. That's beautiful to me. I don't have to give over all my information and my firstborn son to participate in the Bitcoin economy. And there's multiple different ways to do that. And it's very important to me that we don't lose sight of where we are. And keep in mind, you know, I'm a nobody. I've not been around this thing since 2011 for my own reasons. But when I just made a conscious decision to get onto Twitter because I felt like I wasn't doing enough. When I made that decision to get onto Twitter, I did it for a reason. I feel like a lot of times people use seniority in Bitcoin as a way to dismiss the concerns and the thoughts of the quote unquote new guys. And I think it should be exactly the opposite of that. Obviously, it's important to respect all the work and the groundwork that's been laid. We're all standing on the shoulders of giants, no question about it. But dismissing the concerns that new people that are entering into this thing new, they're looking at it through a different set of eyes than you. You may still be seeing Bitcoin the way it was when you got in, and now these people are seeing Bitcoin the way it is now when they're getting in. And so it's very important that we listen to everybody. Nobody should be without a voice, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. That's what this whole thing is about. Bitcoin is enemy money. I no matter if I like you, dislike you, I feel like you should have the right to be able to transact, and you should be able to do that in a private manner, regardless of how I feel about you. So the crayon thing is a shot back from some of the samurai crew guys. I see you. We're out here. You know what we're doing. We're taking Bitcoin to the streets once again.
All right, man, that's a great place to end it. How can we keep up with you?
I put some links at the bottom of the thing, so that's the reason why you'd have to read all the way to the bottom. I am at Diverter, no KYC on Bitcoin. You can find me on Keybase. Find me on Telegram. That's the reason I released this on Keybase, is so you know you can prove that it is actually me, so that when you get to start clicking some of these links, you know, you don't maybe take a little bit of that concern of what's getting ready to pop up. But yeah, hit me up wherever DMs are open. If you have any questions or concerns, glad to help.
Fantastic. All right, Diverter man. I appreciate your time, and this was a great chat.
Thank you, man. Same.
All right, that's the show for today. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I loved talking to Diverter about this. I think the more ways that we can figure out how to acquire Bitcoin without KYC, the better. I know that I've kind of been on this kick lately about not doing KYC. I think we just need to do a better job of warning and protecting new users. I think it's dangerous for us to keep pushing, you know, as many gateways as possible when all the new gateways are KYC'd. And I really feel like it's only a matter of time before KYC gets somebody killed. I really believe that. It's bound to happen at some point because governments just trend toward evil. I think we need to find a good way to message that. And I think we need to find a way that's not just scary, but I think we need to start when we are telling people about Bitcoin. We need to say, if you decide to get some, it's best to get it not KYC. You can't stop them. It's their choice, obviously. If that's what they're going to do, that's what they're going to do. But at least you have given them the options. When I got into Bitcoin, that was not something that was, I feel like, very well articulated. And I don't blame anyone for that, right? They were out there. Local Bitcoins was an option. If I had read more, I would have known. But it just wasn't that easy to use, or I perceived that it wasn't easy to use. And so maybe that's part of the messaging that we need to do, is just explaining to people that these things are achievable. You can get Bitcoin without KYC, and it's something you can do. We just need to make sure that we are explaining to people how to do it and encouraging them to do it. You know, if we're going to say that you should, self-custody your keys, and we're expecting them to learn how to self-custody their keys and guard their private seeds and these things, then if they're capable of doing those things, then they're capable of buying non-KYC, and we should encourage that. So, all right, you guys know the drill. You can follow me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC, DM me if you've got ideas for the shows. If you've got thoughts on this episode of how to, if you have other resources for better ways to cool or insulate the noise on these miners, shoot me a message or respond to the tweet announcing this episode, or tag me or Diverter. Love to hear more ideas on that. Go check out Diverter on Twitter, and check out his article that he posted on his Keybase profile. I will link to those in the show notes, obviously, and share the show out with everybody. This is a good episode. I really had fun doing this one. So anyways, all right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.